Okay, good to see everybody tonight. It's cold. Or is that too obvious of a statement? You didn't need to come out here to hear that. You know that. It's freezing out there. I hear it's warm in Florida. I'm thinking about moving there. That's true. At least we didn't get snow. That's true. You know, when I heard that it was snowing up like in Dothan and stuff like that, I thought about driving up there to see it. And then I thought, do I really want to drive in the snow? That's kind of stupid. So instead, I pulled a blanket around me and forgot about it. All right, if you guys got a Bible or something close to it with you, if you open to Proverbs 22, we're going to keep going through the Proverbs here. We're probably, you know, this is only a 29-verse proverb, but it's unlikely we're going to get through the whole thing tonight because I got like 32 pages of notey goodness here, so there's no possible way. I mean, I go through these fast, so I mean, don't let that throw you, but it's still, there's a lot to go over here. Okay, starting in verse 1, it says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. The rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple goes on. The simple go on and suffer for it. The reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. Thorns and snares are in the way of the crooked. Whoever guards his soul will keep far from them. All right, what we've got here in this section, it's kind of thematic. It's dealing with the rich and the poor and the road to ruin. You could almost title it that way. And verse 1 again states a case that has come up again and again all through Proverbs, and that is that character and reputation and honor are far more important, far more valuable than earthly wealth, than material gain that we could amass over time. And verse 2 provides the reason for that, the reason that character matters, the reason that character is far more important than riches is because when we stand before God, we're all equal. When it says the rich and the poor meet together, that's the idea, is that, you know, when it comes to the basics of our humanity, there's no distinction between rich and poor when it comes to being humans before God. We are just humans before God. We're not rich humans before God or poor humans before God. We're humans before Him, and He's the one who made us. No one's less or more because of what they possess. You strip it all away, you take everything away, and we're just simply human beings created by God, made in His image for His glory. No one's going to be able to buy his way out of trouble if he hasn't lived, you know, if he hasn't committed himself to God. He's not going to be able to buy himself out of trouble with God in the day of reckoning, and nobody's going to be overlooked by God because they didn't have enough or they weren't rich enough. None of those things matter in the greater scheme of things. That's why character is so far more valuable. That's why how we live our lives and what our lives mean as we live them out in the world where we've been placed is far more important than what it is that we've amassed. And of course, we've made this case a million times. Our culture goes completely the opposite direction. Our culture prioritizes material gain. We're good consumers. We're trained to be consumers. We're not content until we have amassed goods, and we measure our worth by the amount of goods that we have. And this is what God is saying. This is not important. The most important thing is what's happening here in our hearts before God, because we're all equal as His creation before Him. The rich man and the poor man stand in the same evaluation of God. So since that's the case, then verses 3 and 4 provide instruction on what is really important, what these, you know, to live carefully. That's the concept behind that. Seeing the snares that are ahead of us in the journey and avoiding those things by living wisely, recognizing what's there. And we've talked about that before, that we say that experience is the greatest teacher, but the scriptures reveal to us we don't have to learn by experience alone. We don't have to always have to experience this bad stuff. We can learn either from the word that's been provided to us. We can learn by observing the experiences of others, by seeing the snares that are there and avoiding those instead of just going headlong in that and living humbly before God. You know, no matter what we do or don't have, to be able to live humbly before God and to live wisely before Him. That's the important thing. Moses wrote, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. And that's the concept behind that, to recognize that we're here for a window of time, a limited time only. And we need to live carefully and cautiously, take care of this life that he's given us and live it the way that he anticipated that we would, that he intended it to be lived. And that's the means by which we're going to stay on course. That's the concept in there. That's going to keep us on the path and out of the brambles that are outside of the path. That's the imagery that's provided there. There's a course of our life that's set out. There's a purpose and a plan that God had in it. If we veer from those things, we're going to find ourselves entangled, ensnared in things that divert us from God's original intent, that takes us away from what it is he wanted for us. And our culture, as is true for all cultures, really, I mean, as we just said, prioritizes the gaining of wealth. If we're going to have the good life, to get the good life, you got to have, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, I've got to have enough money that I can be on a boat, you know, or whatever it is. And over and over and over again, we're informed that's the good life. You've got to have that sort of thing. But the scriptures counter that with letting us know that a good life, the good life, is a life that's lived in harmony with God, is a life that's lived fulfilling its original intent and purpose, what it is that God meant for us. And that's not arrived at by prioritizing material wealth over everything else. So all of these things, what they do, you know, I know that we've heard these things before. I know that it kind of is a reiteration of it. But what they do is they challenge us then on a regular basis to examine our priorities, to examine our goals, to look at our priorities in life and what it is that we consider to be the most important things and how we pursue the various things in life. Because we're warned, you know, that's why I guess to me it's so crazy when people come up with doctrines that say that God, you know, if you have enough faith, God's going to make you rich and you're going to be wealthy and, you know, never have anything lacking and stuff like that. And yet I don't see that in here. What I see over and over and over again are warnings about that very thing. It doesn't mean that God is against somebody having wealth or material possessions, but there are huge warnings attached to those things. That is dangerous territory. That's a dangerous place to be. How far is that from our normal thinking about life? I mean, nobody ever says, you know, oh boy, I hope I don't get rich. That's pretty scary stuff. Nobody thinks like that. Everybody's like, I'm going to play the lottery because I want to be a bazillionaire. Nobody thinks about what it is that God says here. This is scary territory to go into. Be cautious of that. Be careful of that, because the most important thing is what's going to happen in our character, how we're living a life that's humble and obedient before God. That's what is going to matter in the day of reckoning. Rich and poor stand alike before God. In the day of reckoning, God's not going to say, what, did you ride on a boat? He's going to say, did you submit your life to me? Did you live the way I intended you to live? Did it fulfill what I had in mind for you? All right. We come to verse 6, and we're going to actually read verse 6, and we're going to skip down to verse 15 to go along with it, because they both go together. And, you know, it's the Proverbs, so we can get away with this, because it's not like we're ruining some continuity. All we're doing is just kind of keeping a theme together. But verse 6, very familiar verse. I'm sure everybody's heard this before. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. And we skip down to verse 15, and it says, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Well, obviously, this is I'm sure that there's not going to be many people in this room that are not familiar with that verse. I mean, has everybody pretty much heard that verse? Train up a child in the way you should. Parents have heard that. Everybody who's familiar with that sort of thing. It's almost kind of like a holy mantra for many Christian parents. And the basic idea that we've developed over time here, and especially I would say this is a fairly recent kind of thing, a fairly recent development. This basic idea that has developed that says that if we provide our children a good moral training. You know, if we provide them good, proper, moral Christian training in their formative years, then they're going to avoid the pitfalls of this fallen world, and they're going to be strong Christians when they grow up. And for many of us, we're kind of thinking, and they're not going to make the mistakes that I made when I was growing up. If I train them and I teach them and I give them a Christian education and all these things, then when they're grown up, they're going to be good, solid Christian individuals. The problem with that scenario is that there is a veritable sea of parents who are disillusioned and brokenhearted because of children that they've raised according to that very premise. You know, they've faithfully homeschooled their kids and shielded them from the world and taught them Bible memorization and took them to church faithfully day in and day out. And as soon as those kids hit their teen years, boom, they've disavowed any trace of Christianity, and they move off and, you know, walk away from it completely. And I know this is true because I have counseled and comforted so many of them, and I have been one of these parents myself. I've experienced this same kind of shock when all of a sudden my children turned out to be human beings and not automatons, as I had assumed. And I've comforted myself. I've even comforted others before, saying, you know, well, you know, it says to us that we train them in the way they should go, and when they're old, they won't depart from it, but we're not promised anything in between. So, you know, we may see all kinds of things happen, and I still think that that's a certain valid kind of thing, but honestly, for some people, that is not enough. I mean, it's one of these things that really can throw a person, because what do you do with something like this? I mean, what do you do with a verse like this? You know, that you have to start wondering. And I've even had people say, is this really, I mean, this kind of feels like it's a vacant promise. I mean, it's like this is bogus. Is this really, you know, can we really count on this as a promise? And I would actually say, well, yes and no. And the reason that I'm saying that like that is because we actually have to step back. And this is important to do, and this is, you know, we're going to go over this tonight, and I realize there's probably not a lot of people here that have kids in that age range, but you can, you know, remember these things and even be there to help, to comfort and pass this along. But first and foremost, we really have to step back and remember what it is that we're reading here. Remember where it is that we're finding this verse. You know, we have a tendency to isolate verses like this and place them in a position of authority that they may not necessarily be carrying that way. Remember that this is the book of Proverbs. This is a book of wise sayings. That's what a proverb is. It's a book of wise sayings. We could say that it's a book of truthful observations about life, where God reveals truths about life and how life is to be approached. And we have to be careful. We have to be so careful about wading through the book of promises and snagging things as we go and calling them promises that are guaranteed for every individual, because I don't know that we can do that. You know, that, you know, if we claim these things, or if we practice these things well, then we're going to get the stated results. That's a guarantee. We got God's stamp on it. That's going to happen. I'm not so sure we can do that. I'm not sure that we're supposed to be doing that with a book like Proverbs, this proverbial poetry that's stating these truths about what life is like and what God's values are like and the way that we're to be making choices. These Proverbs are pointing out the best way to go in living according to God's intended purpose for us, according to God's character that he wants to develop into us, but they're not necessarily supposed to be read as money-back guarantees if we buy into them. You see what I'm saying in that? And I know this could throw some people, but you will find most conservative theological scholars stating the same thing, saying as much. That's why the book is called Proverbs and not Promises. It's a book of wise sayings. And you know, sure, there's truth in the observation. There's God's truth that's revealed in that. And I believe that truth, and it points the way to go. But, you know, we've seen this with other things that are stated in just the last chapter. It says diligence and hard work will bring about wealth. Well, Okay, but on the other hand, diligence is hard work. Sometimes a guy can work very hard, plant his crops, and find that his crops are blighted because he's in a fallen world and things have gone stupid for him. But it doesn't negate the reality that there's a truth in that. If you work hard, it will pay off. I mean, we can all agree with that, right? But we can also see that that's not necessarily a promise. If you work hard, everything's going to pay off that you set your hand to do, right? I mean, we can agree with that. And so we see the distinction there then between a promise and a proverb. The promise, Jesus makes a promise. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. A promise that nothing's going to get in the way of. Nothing's going to alter. Nothing's going to shake that or change that. But a proverb, you know, work hard, be diligent, and your crops will grow. Well, yeah, that's the general principle, but there's a lot of variables that go with that as well. So a proverb is not necessarily a promise. So that's one thing that we have to keep in mind when we're looking at a passage like verse 6. Train up your child in the way you should go. Whoop, there's my guarantee. There's my promise. And when he's old, he won't depart from it. Woohoo! Now I got it. And then, you know, we sit back in dumbfounded shock when it's not happening that way. But beyond that, and I realize we'll have to go into this even a little bit more, because some people would freak out at that thought, and I understand that. You know, some people live in it's either true or it's not. And if it's true, then it's true for me kind of world, you know. So, and granted, please understand that. I understand that. I definitely, you know, understand that perspective and that viewpoint. So beyond just the distinction between a proverb and a promise, beyond just that, the fact that we need to be cautious and careful how it is that we're applying Proverbs, there are some real issues we have to consider in the meaning of this verse. I'm not sure if you're aware of it at all. In fact, in all honesty, I was not aware of it until I began doing the research in preparation for this study. But there is a huge amount of discrepancy and debate about the very meaning of several of the words in this verse. The actual meaning of the word chanak, which means to train up, or the meaning of derech, which is the way he should go. Train up and the way he should go. These two words are in great controversy, you could say, in terms of linguistic experts who are trying to plumb the meaning of this, what these things mean. The word translated for train up is actually only found in four places in the Hebrew Old Testament. It only appears those times. In the other places where that word appears, it does not mean to train or to educate or to provide some sort of formal education or some or moral character building. It's actually, in every other case, it means to dedicate a building. They're dedicating the temple, or they're dedicating the service of the instruments. Some linguistic scholars actually believe that this is actually dealing more with a son's inheritance into a family business, or like a young man being trained for war. They look at it more along those lines. Train, you know, dedicate this child, dedicate this son to the direction of his family vocation, and he'll take that over. He'll, you know, continue that on. They see it that way as opposed to being moral instruction. Which I think that's interesting to me, though there is a strong argument from the other side of that, that saying that the modern usage of that word is now more along the lines of instruction, of teaching, of training. So the modern usage of the word, they say, is found because of the application of the word within that proverb. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying there? I don't know if it's getting complicated or what, but I want you to think about these. These are the important things to consider, because there's a huge amount of pressure placed against Christian parents about raising their kids, and all of it really stems from the fountain of this verse right here. So it seems like it's a pretty important thing for us as Christians to look at this and really examine this, really understand what it's trying to say to us. Now, the other thing is that the meaning of this word derech isn't necessarily meaning the way. When it says, you know, train up in the child in the way he should go. In the way he should go, it's actually one word in the Hebrew. There, we have to insert all kinds of things. The English word should isn't in there at all. Those articles are not in that verse at all. They're inserted by the translators based on what they believe is the intent of the thing. It can mean, it could mean the way, like God's way, that he should go, but they're are many scholars that believe it should be read in his own way. Train up a child in his own way. They believe that it more closely fits the original intent and usage of that word. And that's really interesting. And I don't know if I'm losing you guys yet, but you let me know when I'm losing you. Just fall over or something. But this is really, really interesting to me. Because if it means the way, or I mean the way he should go, or I mean his own way. If it means train up a child in his own way, then this could mean one of two things. It really could. It could go two different ways. If it means in his own way, it could mean to train or instruct a child in a way that is best suited to that child. Because we know that every child is going to be different. Every human being is going to respond differently to different methods and approaches to learning and understanding and all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, I know that between Riley and I, there were huge gulfs of differences between the way we were, you know, responding to training and things like that. Riley was oceans. Riley was, I guess, saved at birth, you know. So he walked around, there was a halo over his head, he barely touched the ground wherever he went. But for me, it was a little bit more of a struggle for my parents. They, you know, there was a lot of training that was necessary along those lines. So, I mean, if it means that, it could be trying to say, look, you know, there's not some standardized way in which everybody is going to receive a blanket training in this. That if you do this and this and this, you're guaranteed with this result. It could be meaning in that, that every child is going to be different. There's going to be different approaches that we're going to need to take in terms of showing them and training them and guiding them and to be patient with that and to realize those distinctions and differences. But conversely, this verse could be read in a completely different way, in a way that many of us may never have ever thought of. I know I didn't until I started researching this, and this is fascinating to me. You could read this as, because remember, train and dedicate could be interchangeable in this. It could be dedicate. So you could read this as dedicate a child to going his own way, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. You see the distinction in that? And the Hebrew supports that sort of a translation of it. So we could be saying in this, you could word it as, you know, if a spoiled child makes a spoiled adult. If a child always is getting his own way all through childhood, when he's grown up, he's still going to be running around expecting to get his own way. That's just the way he is. This very well could be a warning. Not necessarily a promise or some guarantee, a warning which actually fits more to the way the Proverbs are written by and large. You let a child, you dedicate a child to letting him do whatever he wants, let him get his own way all the time. When he's grown up, he'll do the same thing. Don't be surprised that he's impossible to live with because he's always gotten his own way. He's always still trying to get his own way. Just so you don't think I'm nuts, Douglas Stewart's Old Testament Exegesis for Students and Pastors promotes this alternative understanding, actually vigorously says it. If it's a warning, it's actually more in keeping with the general practice of the Proverbs, of what it tries to inform us about. So the question then comes up, you know, we look at that, and for me, it's a refreshing point of view. For me, it's actually an alarming thing when I consider the amount of pressure that parents have been under before, even myself, the pressure that I've been under in this sort of thing. And, you know, we wonder then what, so, I mean, if that's a possibility, I mean, if that's really true, then, you know, if that was mischief, because that's a serious presumption to make in that, to put in the way he should go when the language doesn't necessarily support it. And, I mean, how could this be going on, perpetrated by every translation over and over again? Why would that happen? And Stewart, I believe, hits the nail on the head when he says, the better known a wording in the Bible is, the more hesitant modern professional translators are to depart from it, even when they dislike it for fear that people will not buy a Bible that has changed the wording of one of their favorite verses. And as you think about that, the more popular a verse is, the more of a marketing juggernaut you're going to be up against when it comes to trying to re-understand it. I mean, think about all the consumers that, if you change their favorite verse, are going to suddenly walk away from that particular transmission. I mean, there would be tons of Christian memorabilia, posters and kids have wall hangings and all these different things that you just have to kind of sweep aside if you were to say, well, you know, it's actually, don't spoil that kid. You know, that's not nearly as nice on a Thomas Kincaid poster as these other things. That is a daunting task faced by publishers when you're considering a consumer culture like this, to actually go in and rework something that everybody's so familiar with and loves so dearly. Now, I realize you open that door just a little bit and like, well, then, you know, we could question everything. Maybe everything is mistranslated, et cetera. And I realize that potential exists. And I'm not trying to undermine anybody's confidence or faith in their translation. Honestly, ultimately, I think that the bottom line is we should be alleviated of the pressure and the unnecessary guilt as parents, no matter what, no matter how you read this passage. This is not some guarantee, money-back guarantee. You make sure that that kid memorizes at least 100 verses before he's 16 and he'll be a Christian all the way through. It's not like that. There's not this pressure. And I'll tell you, so many people have, you know, waded through that. So many people have been carrying that burden, some people overtly, some people secretly, carrying that terrible burden that they didn't do enough, that I didn't do this right somehow. My kid's not following the Lord, and, you know, here's this awesome promise, and I messed it up. Well, maybe it's not what you're thinking it is. Maybe we need to reconsider this. Maybe we need to realize these are principles. Obviously, the principle is there to train the children, to guide the children in some way, whether we read it as instructing them in the right way to go and trusting that they'll come back to that value set. And there's research that indicates that. In their formative years, you instruct a child in their formative years on a value set. And as they go through life, as they reach adulthood, by and large, they generally gravitate back to that value set that they first received. But even there, there's a lot of parents that I've known who've said, yeah, but, you know, my kid's in his 40s and 50s, and he's not returned back to it. In fact, he's a, you know, diehard atheist. And so we have to realize that each person's soul is going to be their own. They're going to stand or fall before the Lord. We have to just pray and entrust them to God and trust Him. You know, all of the guilt that seems to flow from this single verse that they feel didn't come true for them, all the guilt that seems to be associated with that, that cannot be God's intent. That cannot be God's purpose in stating something like this. And if that's you, you know, if you struggle with that, just know that this was not God's intent to lay some extra burden on parents who already struggle with enough wanting to see their child go in the right ways. We don't want to wallow in that. Even if our kids have gone astray, trust in God's power to draw them and to save them far more than we would ever trust in our own power to raise them or guide them right. Honestly, there's not a person in this room that came from a functional family. Everybody's dysfunctional. Everybody grew up with human beings. And human beings are by and large broken. And broken human beings just don't do this stuff well. All kinds of mistakes get made. My personality is prone to it. I could just sit in a dark closet for the rest of my life, wringing my hands over the mistakes that I made when I was raising my kids. But that's not God's intent. That is not God's purpose. That's not going to help or solve anything. What we do is we trust God. God, you're big. You're strong. You're loving. You know my kids. You care about my kids. You will draw them in and lead them to your heart. It's not going to be through my amazing parenting skills or my ability to keep them away from R-rated movies or whatever it is we think is going to be the magic key. But what we can take from this verse, especially linked with verse 15, is the responsibility that parents have to guide their kids, to instruct their kids, and provide them with the proper respect for boundaries. And that is so important. I mean, either way that we read verse 6, the encouragement for parents is clear to guide our kids towards what is right and expected from them as adults, what God is expecting from them as adults and what society is expecting from them as adults. That's our role as parents. We're guiding them towards that adulthood that they're going to be moving into. If we indulge our kids, if we always make sure that they get the last word, if we allow for that, if we're always giving in to whatever their demands are for whatever our reasons, whether it's guilt or whatever it is that we tend to be manipulated by, we shouldn't be surprised then that when they grow up, they're difficult people to be around, that they don't seem to interface with society well, because we haven't done our part in that. Our role is to train them towards that. Looking at it conversely, if we teach our kids the right kind of character to live from, like the stuff that we're learning here in Proverbs, as I said, those sets of values are values that they, by and large, will ultimately lean back into, that they'll return to as life goes on. But no matter how it pans out, the most important aspect of that instruction is we're charged with training them and showing them while we have them. Forget about guarantees, about results. Just realize that no matter what, our role in this, God's expectation for us is to train these children, is to instruct them, or better put, to provide boundaries for them that they begin to understand how you operate in life from. And verse 15 gives an example of how that's supposed to work, through corrective discipline. And, you know, at the risk of sounding like an old man here, this is an area where I really feel like our present culture is in serious decline when it comes to discipline. There's a serious deterioration in that process, in that aspect of parenting, just at least from my observation. I mean, it's almost like you say corrective discipline in the context of children. It's like you might as well just be cussing. You might as well just be, you know, firing off a salvo of curse words at a lot of people. It's kind of, oh, I don't want to hear that kind of stuff. Oh, I don't do that sort of thing. And, you know, we really need to pay attention to this. I mean, this verse deserves that kind of attention. It says that folly, or we could say incorrect or inappropriate behavior, is bound in the heart of a child. That is, no one needs to teach a child how to do something wrong, you know, or to act out or behave badly. My kids, I had four kids. I never had to sit them down and say, okay, sometimes things aren't going to go your way. So what you have to do is scream and hold your breath until you get somebody's. I never had to do that. That just was instinctive. I know how to do this. Never had to teach the kids how to steal something from the other kids. You know, sometimes they're going to have something you want, so you'll just have to snag it from them. No, they knew that immediately. Never had to take my daughter aside and say, now, Jessica, sometimes you can't tell the truth. Sometimes you've got to lie to make yourself look better. I never had to explain that to my kids. That's bound in the heart of a child. There's a fountain of that sort of stuff that comes out of us because of our fallen human nature. As human beings, we're skilled at that sort of thing. We're born with that skill to do the wrong thing, and especially as it touches, you know, even moral issues. Now, when it says foolishness, you know, when it talks about foolishness, we don't want to make a mistake here and think that that's talking about acting silly or giggling or something innocuous like that. You know, we don't want to get in some sort of attitude like, you know, the kid starts giggling and stop that, you know, foolishness is born in the heart of a child. And I've known, and the reason I even say that is because I've known parents that were nutty enough to think that that's what they had to do, that, you know, we don't allow laughter around her. And that sort of thing is not what it's talking about. It's talking about bad, potentially destructive behavior. All of the stuff that's associated with the actions and the choices of the fool in Proverbs, because we've contrasted, remember, between the wise and the fool. And the fool has to do with who the person who is choosing a way that is separated from God's intent and God's purposes, what it is that God considers to be right. And so that's what he's talking about. This folly that's represented in this is the folly of going the wrong direction. That selfish, that mean, that lazy, that dishonest behavior like that. Oh, you know, but children are just angels. Oh, only to people who have no children. Anybody who has a child, you immediately know. It becomes very evident to you right away. Oh my gosh, I'm in a war here. This is, you know, I've got an enemy at the gate ready to take over the whole house. We gotta, you know, get things aligned here because this is on. This is on for real. Sometimes it feels that way. This is just stuff that comes naturally to a fallen world. All of these aspects of these things that we say, you know, kids are innocent from. No, they're not. They're born. The Bible says in Psalm, I forget where it is, Psalm 50, is it? Or 150? That the wicked go astray even from birth, speaking lies. The idea is that, you know, from the moment we're born, we're being dishonest. I know it was true with my kids. They were babies, and they would cry for no reason. They were lying to me right there. You'd run in there crying. You run into the room. What's going on? Oh, it must be terrible. Are you on fire? What's happening here? You look them all over. They're perfectly okay. And as soon as you pick them up, they're like, and you realize you just lied to me. You got me out of a sound sleep to lie to me, because that's the way we are as human beings. We're just good at that. So children have to be guided through corrective discipline. That is, that boundaries have to be set and communicated to the child and then consistently enforced. Boundaries have to be set, communicated to the child, and then consistently enforced as they're growing up. Yeah, but that's no fun. Yes, that's correct. That is no fun. That is no fun. If it's fun, there's something wrong with you. But it's no fun. But it's what we're called to do. That's part of our role as parents. We have to do that. That's important to do. It's mandatory for the sake of our children. For the sake of our children being able to grow up and move into adulthood in a way that is going to enable them to properly interface with society. If we're not providing this for them, we are cheating our children. That's why the Bible says we don't love them if we don't provide this for them. We just don't care. And it's an important thing. So how do we discipline our children? Well, the text says that the rod of correction drives away bad behavior. So we think, so I'm supposed to beat them with a stick? That's the idea? Listen, I'm actually going to say that's up to you as a parent. People are going to have to determine that. The use of the word rod in there, the word shebet, is literally means a staff, or, you know, it can mean like a scepter along those lines. It is very possible that word rod is being used figuratively, not necessarily trying to indicate a literal rod, but I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of places where that's used and you take from it the sense of literal, like, you know, a rod on the back of a fool is the thing that's going to turn him around. We look at that and we think literally when we're saying that, though the argument is made that you could substitute the word authority for rod and not damage the text if you were to translate shebet as authority, since it does kind of mean authority. You know, I'm not 100% convinced that we can say unequivocally that word rod means that we're supposed to spank our children. I don't know for sure. I do know for sure that it's telling us that we are to employ corrective discipline with our kids. And I think that each parent is going to have to make that determination on their own. Robbie and I did employ spanking when we were raising our kids for the early years of their upbringing. And honestly, controlled, non-angry, selective spanking to me is a perfectly viable means of enforcing boundaries for little kids. It has always been, all through history, an accepted means of discipline through most cultures up until recent history, up until recent years. And we can see the results of how well that's working by not doing that. Obviously, and I have to say this part, obviously it is something that can be abusive if it is uncontrolled. If somebody's approaching this from the wrong attitude or from the wrong heart. So that makes recommending it as a norm for me as someone who instructs people from a variety of different backgrounds whom I don't know as well as God would know you. You know, for me to recommend that as a norm, that makes that dangerous business for me, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to say you should do it this way or you shouldn't do it this way. I'm going to say you should seek the Lord as to the most appropriate means of enforcing some boundaries. Because each family has to make that determination on their own. But whatever a family decides, we have to know that we are expected to discipline our children in some way that is effective. And effective is the operative term here. Because if I could be candid, I just think that some methodology that's employed is not, at least from my observation, that effective. To stand there and repeatedly say over and over again, Johnny, don't kick, when Johnny keeps kicking the neighbor when he comes over, it doesn't seem to be effective. To continually make commands that have no need to be obeyed because there's nothing behind it to reinforce it. There's nothing behind it that would make it any reason. There's no chastisement that would promote any sort of obedience to it. And not to keep harping on spanking or anything like that, but my mom raised me and she employed spanking and all of the supposed risks that are associated with that in terms of fostering aggressive behavior were just not true with me. They weren't true with either my brother or I. In my whole life, I've been in 3 fights, lost all 3 of them. And I've never been an aggressive person. I've always felt a deep level of empathy for other human beings, never wanting to inflict pain on somebody else. So, to say that it runs that risk, I suppose it does, but I can't say that that's a blanket, a blanket thing, because it certainly wasn't true within my experience. And I would actually think that a lack of discipline at home is what does foster aggressive behavior. Why wouldn't, Johnny do all this stuff? I mean, why wouldn't he just go crazy, kick his little sister or throw chairs in the classroom if there's no chastisement behind it? If there's nothing behind that, the threat, then why not just do whatever you want to do? It doesn't matter, because nothing meaningful is ever going to come from it. And that's what the challenge is for parents. You have to consider what is going to be meaningful and effective in enforcing the boundaries that we've established for our children. That's just what we're called to do. You know, if children... In our culture, in the way it is right now, and you talk to any teacher, and this is true, if a kid gets in trouble in class, parents march down to the classroom to chastise the teacher. How dare you accuse little Johnny of doing something wrong? He's an angel, and you're a beast, and I'm going to see to it that you're fired. And again, I know I sound like an old man, but when I got in trouble in school, my biggest fear was that my mom was going to find out about it. I would say to them, beat me. Do whatever you got to do. Just don't tell her what happened here, because I knew that I was going to face it again at home. But far worse, it's because it's mom. And that kept me more in line than I would have been. It's a strange thing. There's this, in communicating with some parents, there's this fear of being afraid that they're not showing love to the child if they don't defend them in any given circumstance. And I'll tell you, that is just not true. That is a false line of reasoning. That if we always defend our kids no matter what, constantly assume that they're right, we're doing a terrible disservice to them. Because they're learning to manipulate things, and they're not going to interface with society in a way that is productive or helpful to society as a whole. My mom, I don't think ever took my side when it came to getting in trouble at school, and yet I never questioned her love for me. Her love for me was never in question to me. I know she loved me. I know she did. That wasn't an issue. The bottom line is God's expectation of us as parents is to effectively provide boundaries for our children and consistently enforce them so that our children are going to be guided towards an adulthood that is going to be contributing to society, not being a detriment to it. That's God's plan. That's God's call in our lives. That's our goal. I mean, obviously, they're going to learn that as we teach them Christian values. They're going to learn not to lie. They're going to learn that those things are the things that we don't do. doesn't necessarily guarantee their moral state or their spiritual state, but it does provide them a framework from which to approach life. It's a better chance for them to move on into God's purposes and plans. Okay, well, we got through 7 verses. And we'll do the rest of it the next time we get together. So, God, Lord, you know us. You know the difficulties that we have as parents trying to make the right choices. That is such a difficult thing to do. And I just pray for any parent at whatever state that they're in here, whatever stage that they're in life. I pray for every parent here, Father. And I just pray right now that you, by your Spirit, alleviate that pressure and that guilt that seems to have developed through basically the expectations of a subculture that we allowed to take over here. I just pray that you, by your Spirit, begin to minister peace and confidence in our hearts that you are God and that you're in control and that each soul is important to you and that you do the work of salvation, that you, by your power, bring us into your kingdom. And I just pray for every parent's child here, Lord, whoever they may be. I pray, Father, that you guard them, that you watch over them, that you minister to them and lead them in the right way. Whisper to them in those night times and alert them in the daytime and lead them home, Father. We entrust all of our children into your hands. We trust you, Lord God, that you do the great work. We do what we've been called to do, pour out of ourselves what you've poured in. Father, I just pray that you minister these words to our hearts and encourage us as your followers and lead us into the life you intended for us. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Are there any comments or questions about this?